This morning we're going to do something a little different, something that we try to do three, four times a year, and that is become wiser men and women by considering the book of Proverbs. How and why to use Proverbs. The truth is we come into this world lacking knowledge, lacking wisdom. Proverbs helps us gain knowledge. Knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge is extremely beneficial. Knowledge brings power. The more knowledge you have, the more power you have. Wisdom is the ability to apply knowledge in the right way. Wisdom means applying knowledge in such a way that you live according to the wise principles that the Creator has built into this universe. Wisdom means lining up your life in accord with these wise principles. Physical and natural laws, moral and spiritual laws. Wisdom is so very beneficial. It brings divine favor and blessing. It creates success in this life, and it leads to eternal success in the life to come. We want to become wiser men and women. The book of Proverbs is designed to help us acquire knowledge and wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A wise and successful life must start with knowing God and respecting God, fearing God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. If your life is not built on the fear of the Lord, you will never become a wise man or a wise woman. Foolishness is the opposite of wisdom. Foolishness means ignoring God's wise principles. And foolishness results in harm and loss, perhaps even eternal loss. We do not want to be foolish men and women who ignore God and His wise principles. Why should we be familiar with the book of Proverbs? Because our culture is now not only post-Christian, it is increasingly anti-Christian. Our culture no longer supports biblical values and biblical morality. Our culture actively encourages foolish living. We, our children, our grandchildren, need to get wisdom outside of the culture. And we get it from sources like the book of Proverbs. We should be familiar with Proverbs because the Proverbs are true. They are wise. They teach us about God, morality, the importance of good character, the need for righteousness, which is being in a right relationship with God and committed to doing the right things. The Proverbs teach us that God, wisdom, morality, righteousness are connected together and result in successful living. We should be familiar with Proverbs because they're full of practical advice as well as spiritual advice. Proverbs helps us live a balanced life between the practical and the spiritual. We should be familiar with Proverbs because growing in wisdom can become pleasurable. It's like a game. It becomes fun to see into various situations, knowing how something has turned out or will turn out because God's principles were implemented or ignored. We should be familiar with Proverbs because they are short, are relatively easy to understand, and therefore easy to remember and implement. How do we read the book of Proverbs? Proverbs should be understood to be principles, not promises. Proverbs are generally true, but not always true in every instance. Principles, not promises. We should read Proverbs slowly and thoughtfully. We consider different circumstances and people and situations that we know fit that proverb, both good examples fulfilling the proverb and bad examples of ignoring, not implementing the proverb. We learn from the examples of other peoples and other situations, from their successes or their failures. We read Proverbs as individuals, and it's also good to read Proverbs with one or more other people and discuss the Proverbs with them and get their perspective. They may see something you don't see. And as Proverbs says, as iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. And we sharpen each other when we read and discuss Proverbs together. And that's what Rabbi Glenn is going to join me to do right now. Let's turn to Proverbs chapter 29. We'll be using the New International Version. Which is the Pew Bible. See, Rabbi Glenn, Proverbs, is it in the New Testament or the Old Testament? Keep forgetting. All right, that was just a joke, by the way. Those of you who are new at Shema.
Is there something in Proverbs 29 about taking advantage of the congregation?
I don't know. We'll find out. All right, Proverbs chapter 29, verse 1. A man who remains stiff-necked after many rebukes will suddenly be destroyed without remedy. One of the most important things to be in life is teachable, correctable. Human beings don't like to be corrected for the most part, and we find it hard to receive correction. It goes against our, proud human nature, but it is important to humble ourselves and be willing to receive correction, to be teachable. Rabbi Glenn?
Well, two things come to mind. The first is I'm reminded of Hebrews 12, where we're told that all discipline at the moment is not joyful. It's sorrowful. But to those who are trained by it, in other words, those willing to receive that correction, that discipline, afterwards, the writer says, it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. So there's something wonderful about not just that it's, on the one hand, hard to receive correction, but if we will, there is a really wonderful end result to it. We grow in grace through that. But the other thing, Rabbi Lauren, that came to mind is, yes, we want to be teachable and correctable, but there's something also for us when we are having to give correction that I saw in here. And that is, and I think we've all seen it, if somebody has done something and then we confront them about it, if they're willing to apologize or willing to receive that correction, we need to accept that apology and we need to let it go. Because I've seen where people keep getting kind of beat up for the same thing. And there comes a tipping point where it's like, well, forget it already then. We can actually come down too hard on somebody and too often for the same thing. And it can have the unintended effect of them hardening themselves to a breaking point.
Verse 2, when the righteous thrive, the people rejoice. When the wicked rule, the people groan. This is talking about the relationship between religion and politics. You cannot separate religion and politics. The righteous are those who are in a right relationship with God and committed to doing the right things. When those who are in a right relationship with God and committed to doing the right things are in positions of honor in their society, positions of authority. The people are happy. They're benefited. They're much better off. When the wicked, who are ignoring God and God's wise principles, are in charge, whether they like it or not, they do things wrong. They will make serious mistakes with serious consequences. The people groan. We must strive to make sure that people who are righteous, who are in right relationship with God and committed to doing the right things, are in positions of power and honor in our society. Sadly, we are going in the exact opposite direction. We're becoming more and more wickedized.
Wickedized. There's been a lot of groaning the past several years. But like you, I feel that it's important. We have gotten comfortable with compartmentalizing our lives as though how I vote and what I believe don't relate to one another. We can't do that. Our faith should inform our vote. It really does matter.
And you must take into consideration a person's level of righteousness. If a man is pro-abortion, a woman is pro-abortion, they're not righteous. If they're pro-homosexual and pro-transgender, they're not righteous. They're wicked. And that must be more important than their economic positions, how they divide up the economic pie. To me, if that's not your understanding, your priorities, you're not righteous. Verse 3, a man who loves wisdom brings joy to his father, but a companion of prostitutes squanders his wealth. A man who loves wisdom brings joy to his father, a companion of prostitutes squanders his wealth. Children make such an impact on their parents. If you want to have a better life, a happier life, you better make sure that you fill your children with as much wisdom, morality, good character as you possibly can.
Yeah. It seems to me that Yeshua had this proverb, this particular one in mind, maybe when he told the parable of the prodigal son, because that son actually did leave his father's home in rebellion, squandered his portion of his father's estate with prostitutes and riotous living. The father welcomed him back, which tells us about the nature of God. But at the same time, think about all the grief that that father felt for all those months or however many years the son was gone.
A lot of parents make the mistake of, you know, seeking a more comfortable life for their children, you know, spending a lot of time at work and ignoring the children, not being with the children, not teaching the children, not inculcating God's values with the children. That is a tragic mistake. The best thing you can do for your kids is spend time with them, teach them about God, the Bible, morality, good character, heart, you know, these issues, right? Verse 4, by justice a king gives a country stability, but one who is greedy for bribes tears it down. So here's a proverb about leadership. A good leader is a person who is fair, who is just, who is committed to doing the right things, and that brings stability to a nation. The one who takes shortcuts, greedy, willing to corrupt his principles for money, brings instability to his nation, tears it down.
You know, these proverbs, the vast majority of them were written in the time of Solomon. So we're talking about 930 BC, so quite a long time ago. At that time, it was more common for a king to also act in the capacity as judge. We don't have that so much today. So this doesn't just apply to a president, a prime minister, a king. This applies to those who are acting as judges, those rendering or theoretically rendering justice over a nation. This would be just as applicable to the members, for example, of the Supreme Court. And if they are on the take or if they are swayed by interest groups, if they are willing to take bribes, if there's conflict of interest, the same thing is going to happen.
Or politicians who take money from, you know, big interest groups, or corrupt police officials that wind up corrupting the entire police department because they're on the take.
And the whole country suffers when individual leaders are corrupt.
Verse 5, whoever flatters his neighbor is spreading a net for his feet. You know, it's good to say nice things about your neighbor, but if someone is saying too many nice things, he probably has a hidden agenda. He is, in a sense, buttering the toast before he's preparing to eat it, and you're the toast.
And if you're not careful, you'll be toast. It's true. It's true. We should be cautious of flattery. And related to this, never accept a compliment at the expense of a friend or brother. Sometimes people will flatter you, and that's one side of, that's one edge of the sword, and with the other edge they're saying, and I really don't like this other guy, and that other person is a brother in the Lord, a sister in the Lord, or a good friend. Never accept a compliment at the expense of a friend, because that's not even a true compliment. That's flattery. It's when they're trying to divide. I'll give you an example, just quick. I've had people come up to me and they say, "Oh, I love when you fill in for Bob Duco," but I don't let them go on. And every so often, "Oh, I think you do so much better job." I'll just stop them dead in their tracks, and I'll just say, "He's my friend, and he does a very good job. But thank you." Just let it go.
Verse 6, an evil man is snared by his own sin, but a righteous man can sing and be glad. What we do to others undermines ourselves. The more we sin, the more we are evilized, the more we make problems for ourselves, undermine ourselves, trap ourselves. A righteous man who's not doing wrong things, you know, doesn't have to worry. He's free to just praise the Lord. He's got no hidden traps along the way of his own making.
This is one of those verses that goes back to what you said in your introduction, Rabbi Lauren. We could wish that some of these were ironclad promises. We could wish that those who perpetrate evil, it would come right back on them. We could wish that evil would just be eradicated and brought to justice every single time, and it isn't. So this is just a caution that we could wish it was this way all the time. Generally, it can be this way, but again, have to be careful.
Look, life in a fallen world that's satanically controlled and in rebellion against God and is under a curse, there's enough problems that will come to you outside of your own making. Right? Just living in a fallen world, you're going to experience all kinds of problems. Why, Solomon might say, why add to them by, you know, doing foolish, stupid, evil things, you know, on your own? Don't do that. Your life will be better off and happier if you don't. Verse 7, the righteous care about justice for the poor, but the wicked have no such concern. The righteous, those who are in a right relationship with God and committed to doing the right things, they don't just care about themselves. They live in a world. They're concerned with doing what's right and just for those around them, especially for the poor and the oppressed. Many of the wicked are self-centered, and it's all about themselves, and they really don't care how much others are hurting. We can't be like that.
There's so much hypocrisy in the world over this matter. I remember hearing Al Gore talk about the poor and he was basically, what he was doing in context was condemning Republicans as supposedly all being rich, cold-hearted, uncaring, blah, blah, blah. Turns out Al Gore himself is a slumlord, and in terms of his charitable giving, I happened to look it up that year. And the sum total of his charitable giving was like 3/1,000ths of 1% of his income. I'm like, wow, what a generous guy. There's a lot of hypocrisy here. And the fact is that if we care about the poor, we're going to do something about it. We don't need to tell the world about it, right? Our giving should be in secret, right? Because the Lord sees these things in secret. Shouldn't be calling attention to ourselves. But it's just amazing how some people who are the most stingy are the most outspoken about what should be done.
Verse 8, mockers, scorners, stir up a city, but wise men turn away anger. Mockers is a very strong word. It's a special kind of foolish person who is not only ignoring God's wise principles, but he's like making fun of God and God's wise principles and the Bible and, you know, the faith. And there are a lot of mockers in our society now. And the inevitable result of making fun of God and God's wise principles is causing trouble in a city, in a nation, because God's wise principles work. And mocking them, tearing them down, creates chaos. Mockers stir up a city. Wise people know how to calm down a situation by applying truth and wise words, and they bring peace and reduce chaos, reduce anger.
I read this verse also in the New American Standard, and I really couldn't help but think of Ferguson, Missouri. People just stirring up trouble in a city. And it's so easy to do that, and then it really takes effort, real effort, to calm a city back down. It's so much easier to do violence and damage than it is to bring healing.
But the wise man knows how to do it. He knows the right things to do and to say, or to not do and not say, to bring, restore peace to a city or a nation. So be a wise man, a wise woman. Verse 9, if a wise man goes to court with a fool, the fool rages and scoffs, and there's no peace. I think Solomon would say, be careful who you pick a fight with. Get into a controversy with. There are foolish individuals who will not use logic, who will not use reason, who are not committed to the truth, and they will use ad hominem attacks. They will mock. They will make fun. They will exhibit extreme emotion and anger, and you will get nowhere.
Yeah, in fact, the New American Standard says controversy. If a wise man has a controversy with a fool. So not necessarily just in a legal situation. But perhaps you've seen this happen in small ways. Perhaps you're watching a news program and you've got a moderator and he's interviewing two people on opposite sides of an issue. And one person, usually the one having the weaker position, will start making faces and ha 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 laughing when the other person is talking. That's a small example of this very thing at work. When they know their position is weak, when they know they don't have the substance, mockery is the only thing they can resort to, or rage.
Verse 10, bloodthirsty men hate a man of integrity and seek to kill the upright. There are people who have come to the point where they are willing to engage in violence, even murder or bloodshed, and are happy to take advantage of everyone else. And they hate people of integrity who don't follow their example. Those who are people of integrity show them up. And we cannot fall into the trap of, taking from others, especially using any type of violence violence.
We should expect that if we're going to live uprightly, we're going to have enemies. Not that we seek it, but it's almost an inevitability.
Mm-hmm. Verse 11, a fool, and a fool is someone who ignores God and God's wise principles, gives full vent to his anger, but a wise man keeps himself under control. This is a huge issue for many people. Learning how to maintain control, not give in to their anger issues. There's A lot of courses you can take, anger management. A foolish person has not learned how to control his temper, how to manage his anger, and time after time after time, he is inappropriate in his expression of anger or rage. A wise man learns how to control himself, to control his anger. Rabbi Glenn.
Well, how many of you growing up remember what you were told when you get angry? What was the principle? Count to 10. And really, honestly, it can be that simple. Don't just give in to your rage in a moment of time. Just better not to say anything because we're going to tend to say things we'll regret. And then pride kicks in, and then you've got so much water under the bridge, it's hard to back down from that. So just better to wait. Just wait. Don't say.
Or walk away. If you're too angry, do not deal with the situation when you're angry. Calm down first. It might take longer than counting to 10 before you re-engage. I think if you asked Paul what he would say one of the fruits of the Spirit is self-control. So when you are in a right relationship with God, when you are close to God, when you are filled with the Holy Spirit, close to God, you will discover that you have much more ability to control yourself, including what you say, including your anger, including giving in to your anger or rage. So on the positive side, you get close to God, you stay close to God, you get filled with the Holy Spirit, you will have self-control, you will have much better ability to control every aspect of your life, whether it's anger or overeating or overdrinking or whatever it is. Verse 12, another leadership principle. If a ruler listens to lies, all his officials become wicked. You know, this is like corruption from the top down. You want a man at the top or a woman at the top who is committed to truthfulness and integrity. If that leader is not committed to truth or integrity, those around him know it. They follow his example. They'll cheat and steal and cut corners like he's doing. And everything starts getting corrupted from the top down.
It happens in the corporate world, too, where if you have a high-level corporate official and people see that this one person just flatters him and lies to him and in turn is promoted, they're going to say to themselves, what's the use in continuing to work hard and honestly when this guy just lies to this man and gets promoted? You can see how it'll just corrupt everybody around them. So it's important that a ruler be very discerning, seeing flattery for what it is or discerning lies from the truth, because it really does affect everybody.
I am convinced, Rabbi Glenn, that we are living in a time of like unparalleled lies given to us by government in almost every area. These politicians are like pathological liars. I can't trust like a word that comes out of their mouths or, you know, statements or economic. It's really sad. Verse 13, the poor man and the oppressor have this in common. The Lord gives sight to the eyes of both. The wealthy, those who are successful monetarily, power-wise in this world, often do think they are better, they are superior to everyone else. Solomon would say, not so fast. You just remember that there is one Lord, one Creator, who made everyone in his image. Qualitatively, you are no different than the poorest of the poor. You keep that in mind and let it affect the way you treat other people.
In fact, verses 13 and 14 directly relate to each other, and it reminds me of the parable Yeshua told of the rich man and Eliezer, or Lazarus. Whatever our economic station in this life, we're all going to be standing on the same level in front of God one day. And a God-fearing ruler knows this, and so he dispenses justice for the poor, is not going to take bribes, is not going to side with the powerful because it's in his self-interest. So these things are very much related.
Better to be a poor man who is wise and righteous than a rich, powerful, famous man who is foolish and corrupt. Verse 15, the rod of correction imparts wisdom, but a child left to himself disgraces his mother. So Solomon on child rearing. This advice is not so popular in our culture today. The rod of correction imparts wisdom. This is talking about a literal, like, rod, a stick. In some places in the world today, they use a cane, like caning, you know, like in Singapore or other places in Asia, to deal with relatively small infractions. The rod of correction imparts wisdom. It is a painful, quick reminder that your life is not lining up with the right principles, and you need to make some immediate changes. Pain has a way of doing that with us. A child who is not disciplined, who is left to himself, who is left to raise himself, is going to eventually cause disgrace, shame, agony for father and mother. So, the if you want to be a good parent and produce wise children that will be a blessing and honor to you and to society, make sure that you properly, diligently correct them.
You know, there are cultures where sons are so much more highly valued than daughters that sons are basically coddled and spoiled and allowed to do whatever they want. And in these same cultures, women have a very, very bad existence. Islamic culture is one of those. It seems to be the case that boys just basically get to do almost anything they want. And what happens is, as they grow up, they become very dismissive of women. They'll become dismissive of their wives and then eventually of daughters. So this is very, very important.
When the wicked thrive, so does sin, but the righteous will see their downfall. There are times when the wicked thrive. I think we're living in exactly the kind of period, post-Christian, anti-Christian, and sin is certainly thriving and prospering in Western civilization. But sin has a shelf life. It is inherently destabilizing. It is inherently limiting. And so the righteous will eventually see the downfall of the wicked and their whole agendas. It might take a long time, but wickedness, rebellion against God, does have a shelf life.
I've come to look at verse 16 as the day of judgment, basically, because there's so much wickedness that goes unpunished in the world today. So the way I see this being fulfilled is the wicked are going to stand before God, and we will see their downfall. I'm just not putting a whole lot of hope in this world to see the downfall of the wicked.
But sometimes you see it in this world. Verse 17, discipline your child and he will give you peace. He will bring delight to your soul. Again, a principle for child rearing. Correct your child, discipline your child, stay on top of where they're at, and he will bring you peace, you know, well-being. He'll bring delight to you. So if you want to have a life that is full of peace and delight, you make sure you stay on top of your children and know what they're doing and teach them and correct them whenever necessary. Verse 18, where there's no revelation, some versions translate vision, the people perish or cast off restraint. But blessed is he who keeps the law. We need revelation. Human nature is dark and chaotic. And if we don't have revelation and vision of what is right and what God expects, if we cast, you know, we will start crossing boundaries that shouldn't be crossed. We will cast off restraint. And there is going to be, chaos and breakdown of the individual and society. And, of course, I think that's exactly what has happened to Western civilization. We had revelation, we had vision, and we were a much better ordered society. But we've cast off, God's revelation, we've cast off vision, and we are seeing societal breakdown in so many areas. Blessed is he who keeps this revelation, keeps this divine vision, keeps God's instructions, and what's true of an individual is also true of a nation.
I would add that beginning in the 1960s, when Bible reading was removed from the public school, education went downhill. Behavior went downhill. And now those who are seeking to excise any mention of God, any mention of the Ten Commandments, any mention of anything religious from the public square, well, we see the effect of it. We don't live in a static world. We're either moving towards the Lord or away from him. And when we remove that revelation, the scripture, when we take it out, we're left to ourselves. And left to ourselves, it's an ugly picture.
Verse 19, a servant cannot be corrected by mere words. Though he understands, he will not respond. This is not true of all servants, but this is true of many people. They are not motivated by mere words. This is talking about a management style, getting tough with certain employees. They won't be motivated just by mere words. You really have to sometimes get tough, get threatening.
Block their pay.
Get threatening in some way to motivate them, because they are not self-motivated and they will not live up to their expectations. Verse 20, do you see a man who speaks in haste? There's more hope for a fool than for him. Rabbi Glenn, why don't you start this one off?
Oh, boy. Why? Because it hits close to home. Now, when you consider, it's breathtaking when you think about it. Those of you, as you read through Proverbs, there is so much about the fool. The fool does this. The fool does this. The results of the actions of the fool are this. I mean, Proverbs is just replete with good, bad examples, right, of the fool. And so to have the writer say, do you see a man who's hasty in his speech? There's more hope for a fool than for him. Oh, great. But that's exactly how we're supposed to feel when we see this. There's another example. Do you see a man who's wise in his own eyes? There's more hope for a fool than for him. And when you just know how much there is said negatively about the fool in Proverbs, to see that there's more hope for a fool than for somebody who's quick to just spout their mind, it's frightening.
There's more hope for a fool than the person who speaks in haste. and there's not much hope for a fool. So there's even less hope for one who is hasty in their words. Think before you speak. Most of us, by nature, we just, you know, say whatever comes to mind before we think through, is this the right time to say it? Is it the right situation? Is this the right way? Should I say it in letter? Should I say it by email? Should I say it by phone? Should I say it in person? Should I wait until the situation is a little bit different?
Think before you post on Facebook.
I like that. So yes, we need to learn, the wise person needs to learn to control what they say, self-control in the area of speech, and to think before they speak. Right time, right situation, right medium. Are these the right words? Verse 21. This is translated like a couple ways. If a man pampers his servant from youth, he will bring grief in the end. I think this is talking about spoiling a child, spoiling a servant, enabling kind of behavior, not being tough enough. You can ruin that person. And you have to find the right balance between love and discipline. There's a family situation in my family with not a servant, but a young man, and repeated enabling behavior. And it's gotten to the point where this young man is like out of control and bringing grief to everyone around him. And it is very sad, very tragic, and very difficult to correct beyond a certain point. So, don't be an enabler. Don't spoil your child. Don't spoil others. Do not enable bad behaviors. You are not ultimately doing them or yourself any good. An angry man stirs up dissension, and a hot-tempered one commits many sins. Rabbi Glenn.
You said it earlier, Rabbi Lauren, one of the fruits of the Spirit is self-control. We need to really seek God and ask Him to work in us by His Spirit, to give us self-control rather than just react to everything.
It's interesting. If you lose control of your temper, lose control of your anger, you're going to commit more sins. Why would you want to do that? Learn how to get control of yourself. Learn how to control your temper. Learn how to control your anger. It's possible with the help and grace of God. Verse 23, a man's pride brings him low, but a man of lowly spirit gains honor. It's kind of ironic, Rabbi Glenn. People who are proud, and pride is, let's try to define pride. I define pride as the creature not understanding his place before the Creator, and not understanding his place before other creatures. He's basically thinking too highly of himself in relationship to God and relationship to others. As our dear friend Jan used to say, we got to understand that God is God and we are not. And that's the essence of pride, not understanding that God is God and you are not. And so the proud individual, he is thinking too highly of himself, and he will engage in behaviors that ultimately do the exact opposite, disgrace him, bring him lower and lower, cause failure in his life. The man who is of a lowly spirit, humble, is going to rise higher and higher. He'll do the right things. He'll say the right things. He will act in the right ways towards God and man that will enhance him, elevate him. So choose to be the person who is lowly in spirit, poor in spirit.
There's an African proverb that goes something like, the higher the monkey climbs, the more that can see his behind. It's a great proverb. But Yeshua gave a teaching that illustrates this proverb perfectly. It wasn't actually a parable. It was a teaching. He said, when you're invited to a wedding or a great event, don't take this one of the seats of honor, because the master of that party may come and have somebody else much of greater stature and ask you to move down in front of everybody. You're going to be humiliated. Rather, take the last place. And then when he sees you, if he says, friend, move up closer, you obtain honor. It wasn't your purpose to obtain honor by taking the last place, but simply by showing humility, eventually, those who know you are going to give recognition to who you are, what you do. But let it come in its own time, in other words. Don't seek honor for yourself. Just seek to please God. Scripture does tell us, humble yourself beneath the mighty hand of God, and in due time he will exalt you.
Verse 24, the accomplice of a thief is his own enemy. He's put under the oath and dare not testify. I think this is talking about a situation where a crime has been committed, a theft has been committed. You know, the community is summoned. They all take an oath together. I will swear to the truth. And so the magistrate says, okay, does anyone know who stole such and such? And the person who just took this oath to tell the truth doesn't say anything. And he has broken the oath, and he's harming himself. He's now broken an oath. There is, you know, more and more consequences. So I think Solomon would say, choose your friends wisely, choose your associates wisely, choose who you hang out with wisely. They can get you in a lot of trouble, both by what they do and what you say or don't say. Verse 25, fear of man will prove to be a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord is kept safe. Rabbi Glenn, you love emphasizing that we need to fear the Lord and not fear man. Why don't you start this one?
This is one of my favorite verses out of all the Proverbs, Rabbi Lauren. Fear of the man will prove to be a snare. Think about what a snare is. It's a trap set for an animal. So what is it saying? When you are worried about what people think of you, you're not free. If you are more worried about what people think of you than what God thinks of you, you have imposed a form of capture and slavery on yourself. And so we just dare not be fearers of man. When we fear man, we don't speak the truth, or we water it down, or we remain silent when we ought to speak, when we're more worried about their opinions of us. So and the opposite is also true. If you just trust in the Lord, you have nothing to worry about ultimately. But the fear of man always carries a very heavy price.
So make a decision to not go with the majority. It's another way of saying it. And go with the faithful, despised minority. Fear God. Don't fear people. Honor God with your life, your words, your actions. And if there's a conflict with that and what society is demanding, you go with God.
It's not a summons to arrogance. It's not saying be dismissive of people. It's just simply saying don't fear their opinion of you. Don't let what your worry about what somebody else is going to think of you govern the way you act. Simply be free. Fear God, and you will be a free person.
And be willing to be part of a despised minority. Many seek an audience with a ruler, verse 26, but it is from the Lord that man gets justice. Rich, powerful people can benefit you if you can get their attention, and if they want to help you, if you know they will favor you. But even better than that is getting the favor of God. So seek God. See getting on his good side. We can do things but with our lives, our attitudes, our wisdom, that really will get us in God's good graces, so that he really is favoring us, that he really wants us to succeed. That's the kind of life you want to live. You can do things that make yourself to be more, for God to be more favorably disposed towards you. Choose that kind of life, and those kinds of attitudes.
And just know that the Lord is not like an earthly king or an earthly aristocrat or wealthy person. You have his ear whenever you need it. You have an audience with him at any time. And he can benefit you in ways that the earthly ruler wouldn't even, or the rich man wouldn't know what to do. The rich man has riches, a king has power, but the Lord has wisdom and omniscience. So the answer to your prayer might not be the way you would have asked for it, but you're getting a much better result from the King of Kings than you would from any earthly ruler.
Finally, our last proverb for today, the righteous detest the dishonest, the wicked detest the upright. Can't we all get along? The answer is not so much. Yes, you can treat someone, with tolerance, you can treat someone in the right way, but between the wicked and the righteous, there is a real divide. The values are very different, and you see that, of course, more and more in our society today. We used to talk about the culture wars, like in the 70s and 80s, the divide was nowhere near as great as it is today. And really, I would say that Christians, Messianic Jews, we've lost the culture war in the United States, this battle between, good and evil, right and wrong, the righteous and the wicked.
As I looked at this verse in the New American Standard, it was something to the effect of the righteous detest dishonesty. In other words, it's not a person so much that they despise, they detest dishonesty. But then it said the wicked detest the righteous. And you see this all the time now in our public discourse, how strident things have become. But pay attention to the way debate goes on. One person might be condemning dishonesty or corruption, but then the other person condemns the person. So you see that, and when you see one person wanting to talk about the issue itself, the merits of the issue, and then the other person just wants to personalize their attack, that tells you who's the wicked in that encounter.
So hate the sin, not the sinner.
Ad hominem, right. Ad hominem is never, ever a legitimate approach. We talk about the substance of a thing. We talk about the merits, the truth, the real issue at hand. We don't bring down the character of the person.
So we can detest, you know, what someone is doing, but we can still be a gracious, loving individual. If we have to say something to bring correction, we can say something, but we can still be basically loving and gracious, even to those who are engaged in really wrong attitudes and behaviors, right?
Yeah, and we definitely don't want to imitate the wicked, because they will personalize their attacks. We don't want to be like them.
Thank you, Rabbi Glenn. Please stand.